This is our class about, it's really a writing class, because I'm just going to complain about bad things that people do when they submit articles. But the end result is going to be, I'm going to tell you how you should write a good article. And not just for me, though. I'm assuming other editors are this way, but I don't ever talk to other editors, so I don't really know. Obviously, the articles they edit are of lower quality than what we run at Mises.org, so I guess I can't speak for them. But by the time we're done, you'll know what is necessary for a top-quality journalistic type of column for a website like Mises.org, exactly. Top shelf.
Just out of curiosity, raise your hand if you have ever written for Mises.org. Okay, yeah, we got a couple of people in the room. How about raise your hand if you write for other blogs or other publications? Okay, so it's a decent amount. Okay.
And if I've ever rejected one of your articles, just so I know ahead of time.
We got one person here. Okay, that's okay.
Okay. Well, somebody was coming in and talking about submitting articles, so I'm already on a roll. Kind of talking about stuff. So, I don't know, let's just start talking about kind of what Mises.org is and what the audience is supposed to be and all of that. So, the Mises Institute has really two different faces that it presents to the world. There's the academic side of things, and that's the faculty. And they have academic journal, and they run programs like this, which are designed for people who are in academic programs and all of that. And then there's the other side, which puts out content for just the regular layman in an attempt to engage that side of the world. Because, of course, that's always been very important to the Austrian school. It's not just speaking to other economists and trying to make things as arcane and difficult to understand as possible, but actually trying to engage regular people. And, I mean, you can see this all the time, that economics has a bad reputation. I remember a few years ago, I had to go to the doctor. I had the flu or something, and she asked me what I did, and I said, oh, I edit an economics website, and she looked at me like this was just the worst possible thing that anybody could do for a living or read on purpose. I mean, she just couldn't understand. This person was like a doctor, so it's not like she was just too dumb to get it. So economics isn't exactly starting from like the most popular place in the world, which is kind of a self-inflicted wound, I think, that economists put onto themselves. So we're trying to put stuff out there that people can read and organize into their brain in a way that they can use elsewhere and has some applicability to their daily lives. So it's going to be very different if you write something for me than if you write something for Joe Salerno in the journal.
And if you do have questions about academic journals, we've got the QJAE, the Quarterly Journal of Austrian Economics, and we are relaunching the Journal of Libertarian Studies, which is more focused on libertarian philosophy. If you have interest in that, please talk to me afterwards. Dr. Terrell is the managing editor for that. He's the person to talk to. I'm happy to connect you. But if you are interested in the scholarly side, come up to me afterwards.
Yes, and sometimes I'll still get submissions that really belong at the journal, and then I'll send people over there. But for the most part, we're talking about stuff that you want to imagine like one of our donors or one of our regular readers. So this is going to be someone who's like a stockbroker or an accountant or maybe a doctor, and they're getting into their office in the morning and they don't really want to start their day yet, but they want to read something maybe on Mises.org. And so they're going to click there, and they want something that they can read in like 8 to 10 minutes. And they don't want something that's just mind-blowingly difficult with lots of like charts and letters and like A(1) is going to do this and B(2) did that. And if you move the line up, you're going to have a different equilibrium point. I mean, just imagine reading that like right before you start your work day. It's not going to be a popular article, I can tell you that much. And I'm probably not going to want to run it. And so what you are going to want to write is something that someone would read like in a newspaper, albeit for a newspaper for a more informed, more kind of free market leaning group. And so that's what you really want to shoot for, something that somebody can read in their spare time and be both amused and informed. So if your article can be read in a reasonable amount of time. If it contains something where the person finishes the article and thinks, I think I learned something there. And also, if they think at the end of the article is, I was mildly entertained. That was somewhat entertaining when I read that. Like, I didn't hate that, and I wasn't bored out of my mind. It wasn't a slog getting to the end of this article. And I could never figure out what the writer was trying to say. Those are all bad things. You want it to be fun and easy. And I mean, that's what I'm looking for. I'm not looking for each and every article to be some groundbreaking thing. It could be that the body of your work over a period of years is groundbreaking, that hundreds of articles that you write over the years end up really changing people's minds in a very important way. But you can't look at each individual article that way.
Right. And this is something I know that Jeff Dice has talked about throughout the week. Joseph Salerno has talked about. It's like, most people here, your students, probably undergrads, maybe some of you go on in graduate school, become professors yourself. But the thing is, like, you don't have to reinvent the wheel. Right, we've got the ideas out there. You know, we've got Rothbard, we've got Mises, they've done the heavy lifting. What we need, what works, what helps communicate these messages is that you take topics that you yourself are interested in. Think of your competitive advantage. What do you research on your own time? What, for example, I like sports, okay? I've got several articles where I've tried to kind of work Austrian concepts into like the business of the NFL. Problem is, we don't really have a very large sports audience, I've realized, because those articles never particularly do well. But, that's something I can bring to the table. I've got some fresh NFL knowledge. If you have an opening in your fantasy league, feel free to hit me up afterwards. But I use that, which I've got an above average skill set relative to most Austrian economists. And then I can work in basic Austrian concepts within that. And if you can do that with an 800 word article, then that's the sort of content that we're looking for. Something that you bring something unique to the table in terms of your own outside of interest, and then working in kind of core Austrian concepts. That ends up being some of the best content we have. Because again, if you get someone who's interested in football and they just read one Mises quote, that's a small step in the right direction in this world.
Yeah, that's fine. Just have one Mises quote in there or none. I mean, if it's an easy read and it's fun to read, I'm going to be a lot more forgiving on whether it meets some like rigorous criteria as to how Austrian it is. As long as it doesn't have something that's anti-Austrian in it. And that's normally what I'm looking for on that final read through. Is there something in here that's like, that is some pro-war comment or something where they like advocate to raise taxes or something like that? Now, we actually at the Mises Institute have pretty broad ideological tolerance, if you will. We're the only think tank really that has a variety of views on immigration, for example. And I'm willing to consider all sorts of different authors and sources and different points of view and so on. I mean, within reason. I'm not going to run your article that says that this sort of tax is a great idea or that really rent control isn't that bad. And I mean, one question I would ask myself is, this is the sort of thing that somebody could read on 10,000 other websites. I mean, I'm often confused when people send me something that would be perfect to run in like some mainstream left of center publication, but for some reason they think it should go on Mises.org. I mean, if it could just go in, I don't even know what, The Atlantic, I guess, then run it in The Atlantic. Of course, what's really true a lot of the time is that person who just has like that really mainstreamy left of center opinion, the reason they sent it to me is because The Atlantic already rejected it. And so I guess maybe they're hoping they can get it on our website or something. But no, I'm looking for something that's going to be unique, that's really going to reflect our point of view. But at the same time, I try to not really keep everyone rigidly within some very slim thing. If it doesn't really run afoul any of those things, but it just offers some new information, and you don't have to hit everybody over the head with some conclusion either. In conclusion, I just wanted to note that freedom is better than slavery, and everyone should agree with me, the end. I mean, you can just leave off that last paragraph entirely, because what people are really reading it for is that interesting stuff that where they just learned something they didn't know about before. People get that if it's at Mises.org, the author probably thinks that freedom's better than slavery and that this information you're presenting is in the service of that general idea. So you don't have to really belabor that point. You could use the space available to you to just present more interesting information.
And some of the things that end up doing particularly well for us is, like, you know, everyone, you know, I'm sure everyone in this room has done it. You know, you're in a Facebook debate with someone, and you know, you're trying to make a point, and so you just go to Google and you type into something that just proves your point, right? And you just throw it in there. You know, the ways, you know, of communicating, you know, getting, we love factual information, like when, you know, comparing and contrasting, for example, the performance of European states. I mean, one of our most popular articles in the last few years was one by Ryan did. I mean, he cranks out like half our content anyway, so I think the majority of our popular articles come from Ryan. And it was looking at the actual cost of living basically that European countries were poorer than most American countries. And it was looking at, like, incomes on average. It was counting into, you know, he's already working in government program benefits, right? So they can't just say, oh, well, they have, you know, they get free healthcare, right? No, he already factored that in. And, like, being able to go, having an article that says, you know, Americans are richer than Europeans, right? That's a very useful article in Facebook debates, right? So anything that's useful, like, say, if you find yourself in a topic where you're debating, that making the same point time and time again, well, that right there is probably an article that other people would find useful, unless you're really weird, which I'm sure there's a couple people in here that might fit that. But, like, you know, it's that sort of stuff that ends up being very, very effective on social media, which obviously helps drive traffic, which helps us. It also helps get your name out there. You know, it's useful content rather than you know, trying to create some brand new theory and you know, some original work. It's something that's useful in, you know, back and forth debate, I think, ends up being.
And the best way, of course, to guess about the sort of articles we run is to read the articles on the site and to be very familiar with them and to show some familiarity with what other people are writing and that sort of thing. I'm often shocked sometimes when people submit topics which show no awareness whatsoever of, like, the 50 articles already written on that topic that ran within the last 5 years. And apparently none of that matters to this new author. So it's useful to kind of build on what's already been done. And topic selection. I mean, I get a lot of questions about should I run an article on this topic, and often they're fine. It's just I can't promise if something's going to be runnable until I actually see the article. But I should note, kind of, like, regardless of topic, just kind of the way it works is, so we already talked about being aware of what your reader audience is, right? This is a lay person, probably pretty smart, and they only have so much time to do this. But the other audience that you have is me, in that this is something that when Ryan sees my name in the inbox, will he be happy or will he feel exhausted? Because I've now given Ryan an errand where he has to read the article and then explain to me why this article was rejected. And there's nothing more delightful than getting an article in your inbox where you know as soon as you see the person's name, oh, I'm not going to have to edit that hardly at all. I'm just going to read it real quick, and then I'm going to cut and paste it into the website, and then I'm going to get on with my day. And my preferred part of my job is writing my own articles. That's just what I find most interesting. I like the process of writing. And I like doing that sort of thing. So the editing part is just something I have to do. And so if an article comes in where I can just spend a few minutes on it and I'm done, that's like a cherry on top of my day. That makes me so incredibly happy. So I want everything that comes in to be amazing. Like, I don't want to reject stuff. I don't want to not like stuff. I want to find everything delightful and interesting. And so I take no pleasure whatsoever in telling people, well, rewrite this, specifically this paragraph, et cetera, et cetera. It's all very exhausting. I learned a bit. One of the best training for this job, by the way, was when I used to teach political science part-time at the college level, and there were a lot of papers assigned. And I did that for like 8 or 9 years. And you would have to grade the paper. And it was kind of similar to this in the sense that if it was a great paper and you could just give it an A, you didn't have to explain to the student why they got an A. Hey, good job, A. And then you move on to the next paper. But like a B-minus paper, a C paper, that takes forever to grade. Because you got to go through it. You got to, like, make comments. You got to explain to the student why they didn't get an A. I guess not all professors do this, but I felt like an obligation to do this. And, I mean, who wants to do that? Which, by the way, I think is one motivation for grade inflation. Just give everybody an A minus and saves you work as the instructor. But so I would have preferred that everybody wrote A papers. But unfortunately, that's not what happened. So I would explain to them what they had to do. And so, and a lot of the things that I would tell people what they had to do then was the same thing as now. Use concrete examples, like create a mental image in people's heads that they can understand. Don't use like a bunch of vague terminology about, well, if you imagined a group of people with no particular name, so now I'm imagining in my head just kind of this like vague group of people. If they do X and then this group does Y, then Z might happen. I mean, now I have no idea what's going on. It would be better if like you used maybe like a historical example that people could follow, or maybe a real world example right now, or maybe at least a thought experiment where the people had names and they were interacting with like real like physical things I could imagine in my head and so on. So all too often people who are at, you know, kind of our level, they're graduate students and so on, and they're just thinking a lot in abstractions. That just doesn't work in this format in something like Mises.org. You got to be like using like real visual images that people can imagine. Also, once you make a point and you say, this is the way things are, then you need to have examples, preferably two or three. So examples are always very important, preferably real world examples if you can. And just to have something that is easy for the reader to follow. And it shouldn't have to be something that seems real academic-y. And then other useful things are like compare and contrast. This is a good thing because X, and it's different from this bad thing. Phrases like, on the other hand, are really good. Or phrases like, nevertheless, or however, or and yet. And all of these conjunctions that maybe if you had a good English teacher taught you those sorts of things in essay writing, all of that stuff still applies now. You got to be like making distinctions. That's an old Latin phrase. It was he who teaches well makes distinctions. So I'm taking two similar things, but I'm showing you why those things are really not that similar, why they're different. And all of these little things are what make up a good article. Because I'm reading it and say, oh, I never thought of it that way. Or I guess those things really are different. Or those things that I thought were different are actually kind of similar. Or this thing isn't like that thing at all. And look at all these amazing sentences that use nice conjunctions and tie together phrases like on the other hand and so on. And that's an old economics joke, right? Where some politician was complaining, I don't know, what's the old joke? Like economists have to have like so many hands because every sentence contains on the other hand. Because economists were never willing to just say, this is the way things are. They were always explaining that there's trade-offs and that this might lead to that and nothing's perfect. And so everything you do costs you something else. And those are the sorts of things we need to include in our articles, especially for the reader to note that we're not naive, that we've taken into account a wide variety of different things, but we're also helping you understand how these things are different or similar. Or this one thing I'm going to explain to you that's important, here are all the examples of this thing in the real world. And so by the time the person's finished their 10 minutes, they're like, oh yeah, that was easy to understand because it was all like real world stuff, I get, or they're talking about like apples, or they're talking about houses, or they're talking about like homeless people, something that has an image in my head, and I can proceed from there.
And you know, one of the great things about Mises, we have so many people from so many different countries, different backgrounds. Again, like the examples of what's going on in other countries, you know, there's a lot of really good lessons that can be educational for an American audience. You know, we were talking with Professor Dominiak about some Polish history that he thought had some relevance. You know, that stuff we're not afraid of, you know, simply because we're a majority American outlet. There's something to be said about the value of looking at history and looking at experience. And I know Patrick Newman made this point during his Conceived in Liberty talk. You know, people like Rothbard saw that, it's you're looking through history and showing these examples working is some of the most persuasive stuff that we have as libertarians. So that's another thing to think of. If you have something that's you know, back home in your country that you think has some interesting libertarian relevance, you know, helps make an argument for free markets, that makes an argument for political decentralization, which is always a winning thing. I know Jose Nino, he's got had some very interesting articles on Venezuela and some political decentralization themes there. You know, these are great topics for our outlet.
Yeah, and also if you write in other languages, if you do an article in another language, you can always translate it and then send it to me. If it ran somewhere else in another language, I'll run it in English. It's not even really technically the same article, so that's always fine. And I sometimes do that. I'll even keep an eye out for other people's. We have a guy named Fergan Azihari, a Frenchman, and he writes a bunch of stuff in French, but I keep track of what he writes in French, and then I ask him to write it in English if it's on a topic that we want. And so if you are doing that, if you're writing stuff in other languages, other places, then consider sending it to us also. And as a final note, I mean, I'll take a question here in a minute, because I noticed there were a couple questions maybe in the back. I just want to note that one way you can help yourself is just to familiarize yourself with column writing, not necessarily for us. Just like there's a lot of resources out there on how to write a column, how to write a journalism type article, and they're usually going to tell you things about how you need to present the most important information near the top and kind of tell us what the subject is. Like, there's nothing worse than when I have to get in like 6 or 7 paragraphs in order to figure out what is the topic of this article. I don't even know what it is that I'm reading about yet. And there's lots of like big words and stuff, and then they finally get to the point like halfway in. The purpose of the article, remember, is to amuse and entertain and inform, not to convince everybody how amazingly intelligent we are. And I think that's kind of the problem we sometimes encounter is, you know, I'm sure people, if you amuse and entertain them, they'll have a higher opinion of you than when they started. I mean, that's kind of like, that's the best service you can do for another person. And but that's what they used to teach journalists, at least, was when you start writing an article, you need to start immediately with what the subject matter is. You tell us basically where the article's headed, and then all of that stuff below that, that's where the examples go. That's where the case studies go. That's where all the information that fills out the topic that makes me feel informed by the time I'm done. And you can get that sort of information on writing on any number of topics, but that basic skill of writing in that format is the same no matter what the topic is. And so that could help you quite a bit as well. So does anyone have questions or anything? I mean, somebody had a hand up earlier in the back, but maybe they don't care anymore. Yeah. You. Yes.
Okay, so my question is, what kind of expectations
can someone outside of the country have with writing for the Mississippi? Well, if you sound like a native speaker, then it's not going to be an issue at all. Or if you're pretty close, I'll go through it and brush it up. Especially if it's on a topic that I'm not going to get that topic from any American writer. So say you're like from Argentina and you just wrote like an interesting article about the Argentinian economy. I'm probably not going to get that from many native speakers. So I'm going to be interested in getting what I can on that topic. So as long as you're pretty close. I mean, if I've just spent a long time rewriting it, then I wouldn't. But I am interested in that, and it doesn't have to be perfect. I mean, does that answer your question? Well, it's not a lucrative job, I'll tell you that much. Sure. Well, if you write for us, that helps you. I mean, you're already here, it eases you. I mean, but we will tell people that writing for us helps you later when you want to like go to Mises U again, or you want to apply for a fellowship or something like that. Those serve as writing samples for you. As far as writing, getting paid on a regular basis, that's something that can be achieved if you become one of those people where it doesn't require any editing, and it's just this person becomes a fixture. So this is a person I regularly get articles from. They're reliable. I don't have to really edit their articles significantly. That's the sort of person that we would pay. If I have to spend 20, 30 minutes editing somebody's article or more when they come in, I don't really want to pay that person because it's actually not saving me much time and work. But yeah, a lot of the people who get paid now, they've been around like for a long, long time. You'll notice, right, some of the old guys on the site who have, you know, I mean, they've got stuff going back like 10, 15, 20 years. A lot of those guys get paid when they're regular writers. Sometimes people who have a particular area of expertise. But in most cases, it's got to be somebody who's writing stuff that actually saves us time instead of adding a need to spend a lot of time editing it.
I mean, if you're providing consistent value to the Institute, you know, then you know, we value that, you know, and that's great. Again, being a MisesU student definitely helps with that a lot. I mean, for one, you get the framework, obviously, that you've learned throughout this week. You know, that helps us put a little bit of a stamp on you, which always helps. You know, we can say that you're a Mises Institute scholar by going through our programs. That's always useful. But I mean, usually, I mean, and Ryan just talked about, you know, putting the good information at the front. You know, usually when we start this talk, we talk about, you know, not just, you know, how to write for Mises.org, but why should you write for Mises.org? Because again, I do think it's a great platform. You know, we're one of the largest, you know, most read econ blogs out there. We have, you know, every month we have, you know, well over a million views. Not only do we have a great built-in audience on the site itself, but we have other outlets that republish our work. I mean, Zero Hedge has a pretty large audience itself. They love republishing our stuff. There's several European sites that republish our stuff. Business Insider at times does as well. Good old Alex Jones's InfoWars republishes. I'm a proud info warrior that I can bring up occasionally in certain audiences.
Yeah, and I can't get those articles removed.
They don't ask for permission. They take it. But we have a lot of people that do republish content. I mean, there's even an Alabama-based website, Yellow Hammer, that has some pretty good Alabama news. I mean, they draw from that. So it's always interesting seeing those sources that republish our stuff because it is so readily available. So that we help amplify the reach there. We also have a very active Spanish language part of the website where, you know, we have a set of translators. So that's pretty cool too. And then we have other organizations that will pick up articles that they find relevant to their audiences. So I've had articles that have been translated to German, translated to French, translated to Chinese and, you know, Japanese, was very interesting. Mises Brazil will pull articles from our stuff. So it's a really cool way of building an international following for your work, publishing for our website. And then one of the last things that we're trying to do to, again, provide additional value to our writers is we're doing more audio translations of our stuff. So again, you can publish a single article for us, have it put, you know, have it translated into Spanish, have it turned into a podcast, possibly have it translated several other times, possibly having it republished in other outlets. And if you do that consistently, then you know that gets you'll get some attention for it. I mean, we've had some people that have been able to spin that off into some blog careers for their own. I mean, you even had Bob Murphy, you know, get talked about in the New York Times by Paul Krugman because of an article that appeared on Mises.org. Noah Smith occasionally likes to take, you know, it's often people taking whacks at us, but that's fine. That's great. So again, there is a lot of value that being a regular contributor to the Wire that can bring, including, you know, potentially even financially, if you're creating consistent value that helps you stand out from the pack.
And I should note that although people look at me, think I'm a very grumpy man and maybe not very nice, I'm actually a very nice man. If you email me something, I'm going to answer you as best I can and actually try and help you improve. Because my goal is when I get people sending me articles, I don't want to tell that person to just get lost. I would love to cultivate a relationship with that person as a writer. And there are some writers where I've seen market improvements over sometimes just a few months where you give them a bunch of feedback and they take that to heart. And then 6 months after your initial interaction, they're writing much, much better articles and writing more frequently. And so that's like my, you know, obviously I would prefer everyone to come to me just like a perfectly formed, amazing writer right off the bat. But failing that, I'm always happy to work with someone until they can then consistently produce the sort of thing we like. And that's great, especially then if they become regular to us and don't feel that they need to go to other publications. And so the problem with email, of course, it might come across that, you know, as I say, you know, you need to fix this and that, that I sound grumpy, but I'm really not. I mean, and also you don't have to worry about me like making fun of you to anybody or anything like that. I work alone. I have like one friend. So I never socialize. So it's not like, you know, Ryan's snickering about some article of mine he disses. It's not going to happen. I forget about it as soon as the day is over. So I'm always happy to see someone trying again or sending in another article that then maybe we might be able to use. So I would encourage people to try if it is the sort of thing you actually want to do.
Yes, Ford.
Well, I can tell you that something just inspired me with my own writing was always a lot of those historical articles that you would get at The Atlantic. I remember reading an article on the history of the crosswalk at The Atlantic, and it talked about how roads used to be just primarily used by pedestrians, and that it was the car that was seen as always had to yield to the pedestrian. And it kind of like went through changes in law that took place, and how these local governments had tried to place mandate special devices on automobiles that would slow them down within city limits and all of this stuff. And cities had these really low speed limits and all this thing. And then it looked at over time, all the automobile companies lobbied the state legislatures to change the way that the roads were used, and then we created this idea of the crosswalk then. And then if you didn't stay in the crosswalk, then you were jaywalking. It was this like 20th century invention. And it was also relevant back at the time because then people were like getting beat up and murdered by cops and stuff for like jaywalking. And so I read this thing. I'm like, this is a really fascinating topic, right? By the time you're done reading it, you never look at a crosswalk the same way again, or like at pedestrian auto relations the same way again. So that's why I would end up writing articles on things like parking structures are like the livery stables of today, like looking at how you used to have to park your horse like 100 years ago and how it was really expensive. So when people claim they want free parking all the time, this is like a really anti-libertarian thing. Actually, is that paying for parking is actually the libertarian thing. And you're right, there's no such thing as a free lunch. But in order to really make that case, you had to delve into like this obscure history that I found really, really interesting. And where else were you going to find an article about livery stables? Like nowhere. And so I kind of like that kind of thing. And it's not the sort of thing that like hits you over the head libertarianism-wise, but it's not something you're not going to read anywhere else. And it's a real easy topic to understand. And it was fun. I mean, so stuff like that. I mean, Chris Kalten, I always encourage because he would write lots of obscure articles on, like, you know, this guy that really wanted to outlaw cocaine in such and such a way at such and such a time and stuff. And that sort of history you don't really read anywhere else, or like the history of the cornflake or something like that. I mean, and bringing into, you know, how government regulation created the breakfast cereal or something like that. I like that. And it's actually hard to find that. But certain publications, which have a generally left of center slant, like The Atlantic or even sometimes The New Republic, which is horrible on foreign policy and stuff, they have some nice, really deep dive articles that I find really interesting. And I think there's just, if you read a lot of books, there's like a limitless number of topics that you can really pursue on that. But you gotta, in order to know about those weird, obscure things, you gotta like read a bunch of stuff that's not just the usual fare.
Well, one author, and it's going to sound, you know, just bear with me for a second, but his older stuff, I thought he was a very entertaining way of talking about economic concepts. It was actually Paul Krugman, but usually it was his older books and you know his articles. And I mean now he's just a completely just partisan hack, and I mean it just, you know, it's his stuff isn't even really worth reading at all now, even for just getting that other little taste of it. I mean, just becomes so just delusional himself, but his old writings were very entertaining, and he would find like these real world his whole argument against about the dangers of deflation had to deal with this story about this babysitter co-op in DC where they had these coupons that they would use to trade like babysitting hours, and like, oh, you know, there ended up being a recession because nobody wanted to trade these coupons because they wanted to make sure they had them for later. And again, I think his concept, I think there's some issues there structurally with what he was saying. But I thought he did a very good job of communicating these ideas. And he also has one of the most entertaining economic papers out there, which is like the theory of interstellar trade, which is kind of this humorous trade theory paper. So I really recommend like his book, Return to Depression Economics. Again, it's wrong, but it's useful to see that other side. And I think that there's some aspects to his writing style that I think that any good econ writer could borrow from. Just not his latest stuff.
We should probably let people go. I believe we're out of time. But I'll be up here if anybody had any additional questions.
One last thing. Also good content for us is always looking for some good econ tweets and other social media content. So again, if you're very active on Twitter and you think you've got, I mean, I'll judge how good your tweets are. You know, I'm not going to take your word for it. But please, please feel free to hit me up if you're very active on Twitter, because I'm always looking for some easy commentary that way.
Okay, great. Well, hopefully this was useful to you. Thanks.